Hi, this is Ralph Lennon, and I'm happy to be back for another lecture on advanced functional programming. So today's topic will be language interpretation. And you might remember that we were playing already with interpretation. You know, in the context of the expression problem, we would have this evaluate function on constant and addition expressions. And in this way, we already interpreted a tiny language. So in this lecture today, we will kind of really stress this topic by going actually through an evolution of an interpreter. So we start from a really simple interpreter, and then we will add language constructs and, you know, come up with some interesting issues around interpretation. And that also kind of implies that we will look into some more advanced functional programming techniques. And indeed, one might say that interpretation, or language processing more generally, is perhaps the functional programming domain, and this is why I've picked up this subject for today. So I will tell you a little bit more about the plan for today and why we are doing interpretation, but, you know, let's get started with our initial interpreter just to get into the subject. So our initial language is basically just for generating the natural numbers. So we have a zero construct, and we have the suck construct for the successor function. So we can basically generate the natural numbers. So if we, you know, interpret this little program here, the interpreter returns 2, right? Okay, so, and when we discuss interpreters today, we always consider like these four ingredients. We have syntactic domains, semantic domains, semantic functions, and perhaps some auxiliary functions. So for this very simple initial interpreter here, these are our syntactic domains. In fact, there's just one syntactic domain. And there are like two constructs as we discussed. So this is our abstract syntax. This is what we are going to interpret. Then the semantic domains, these are Haskell types in our case that we need in order to describe the possible results of interpretation, or to describe any other types that we need for the interpreter. So we always have like a designated type value, and that one describes the types of results that an interpretation can yield. And then in this particular case, the only kind of result that we may see for our initial interpreter is natural numbers. So, well, and well, we use Haskell's inType as an approximation of natural numbers, while we just kind of commit ourselves to not using the negative part of it, okay? And then here's the actual interpreter, if you like. It's the semantic function that maps expressions to values, and those semantic functions got to be defined by case discrimination on the constructs of the language. So there's one equation for zero, there's another one for suck. So the interpretation of zero is that we return the value zero, and we interpret the suck construct, you know, relative to the subterm x, by first interpreting the subterm x and then applying the increment function to this intermediate result. So the kind of style that we're using here in defining the semantic functions in, you know, delivering our interpreters today is the one of what I would call this naive denotational style. So for those of you, you know, who have some background in programming language theory or semantics in particular, you know that there's like axiomatic semantics, operational semantics, and denotational semantics. And even though we don't use a very formal approach here today, so it's more about programming interpreters, but nevertheless, our approach is inspired by denotational semantics more than by any other approach to semantics. Well, I call it naive to denotational semantics because I really don't use any mathematical style here. Okay, well, so auxiliary functions for our initial interpreter, this is very simple. So we basically need function application, addition, and zero, right? So this is what we just saw in the semantic equations. So let me tell you a bit about what's the plan for the rest of the lecture. So we will go through this evolution of our initial interpreter. And this will bring up those issues here. So we will add some language constructs so that interpretation becomes partial. We have to deal with that. And then we will also kind of complicate issues by having different kinds of result types, which means that the interpreter needs to carry out type tests. Okay, and then we will come to the interpretation of the lambda calculus, which involves the challenge of constructs that involve binding. So, and then we want to actually deal with the interpretation of recursive functions, so we have to model recursion. Okay, and one important principle underlying the kind of naive denotational style that I'm using here for the interpretation is the compositionality principle. So I'm going to explain you what it is and why we need it. And then, actually, I should point out that today this lecture is just a starting point for a series of lectures where we can actually leverage this interpretation domain for other purposes. For example, some of you might already wait for a lecture on monads, and it turns out that monads nicely pop up in the context of the interpretation domain. So we will just continue next time and look into monads. And then many of you also remember and also know about like maps and folds, particularly for lists. And it turns out that there's a nice generalization for folds, that can be applied to basically any algebraic data type, in particular also to abstract syntaxes in interpretation. So this will be another subject soon. And then, we can also play with this interpretation domain to study a little bit more the amalgamation between functional and overall programming. So let me just point out again, interpretation is a really cool domain for us as advanced function programmers, because it is the functional programming domain. Okay, so we want to get into our first evolution step. So we are going to deal with partiality of interpretation, and this is based on the following little language extension, where we add a predecessor construct to our language. So we had 0 and suck before. Now we also have pred for predecessor, so we can basically compute successors and predecessors. Okay, but the issue, of course, is as we see here, you can't take the predecessor of 0, so predecessor operation is partial, and this also has an impact on our interpreter. So now the interpreter needs to be prepared for failure, right? So we wrap up the value result position here of the function signature in the type constructor maybe. So this means interpretation may either return just something, if you like, just a value, or nothing. And this means that the interpretation is failing, okay? So the syntactic domain is affected quite simply as follows. We just have to add another constructor declaration for the new construct, right? There are no semantic domains that need to be added here. However, the equations for the semantic function interpret are affected. I mean, you see three equations now because there are three constructs, and you see that the equations for the pre-existing constructs, of course, look differently because they now need to deal with partiality. So interpretation of 0 is pretty simple. We just return 0. Interpretation of the successor construct is a little bit more involved. So even though the successor construct by itself doesn't cause any partiality issues, it has to deal with partiality because of the recursive positions here. So, because when we interpret the subterm, that subterm may fail, and so this equation has to deal with partiality indeed. And so what we do here is we use a new operator. I call this the partial function application operator, as opposed to the regular function application. So because we have to kind of compose a function, in this case the increment function, with some term that may possibly evaluate to nothing, right? So in that sense, it's partial function application. So here we see how partiality really pops up with the predecessor construct. So again, we kind of evaluate the subterm, and then we apply an auxiliary function pred here, and you see we check for the intermediate result to be greater 0. Only in this case we allow ourselves to decrement, otherwise we return nothing here right away. So we need to understand how this partial function application exactly looks like. So this is our auxiliary function that we need to introduce in this extension. And so you can see that this operator is really, just by looking at the type, it's really sort of a function application. There's a function to apply, and there's an argument, and there's a result. So, and you also see that this type here, type A, sort of matches with the argument type of the function, right? You also see that this result of the overall function application also matches with the result of the function that we want to apply, right? Except that, you know, here we have a maybe, and here we don't have a maybe in this position. And this is exactly the contribution of the partial function application, that it sort of propagates nothing from here to there, but if this is a proper value, then it applies this function. Okay, so actually the definition of this partial function application is trivial if we are aware of the fact there's already a kind of implementation of it in the prelude. So this is the maybe operation, which is basically a case discrimination, a kind of a fold on the algebraic data type maybe, and so we can just use it here to do this propagation of the value nothing, okay? So before I continue with some other evolution steps, I want to spend a little bit of time on compositionality. So here is sort of the definition of compositionality, and I think it's best explained with our example that we developed so far, except that I refactored this interpreter a little bit, so that I factored out, you know, all the incrementing, decrementing stuff into assumed auxiliary functions f sug and f prime. So we kind of focus on the real structure of the semantic function here. And so what you see here is that interpretation is really defined by case discrimination. And these are just very flat patterns. So we look at the constructs one by one. So we only bind like the immediate subterms. And then on the right-hand side of those equations, we indeed interpret those immediate subterms. And then we apply some functions on top of these intermediate results that we obtained from those interpretations, right? You know, if you think of interpreter functions as meaning-giving functions, then compositionality means that the meaning of a compound term, or let's say of a language construct, is determined in terms of the meanings of the subterms of that compound term, right? And so here the kind of the hidden assumption is that those functions that we apply on top of the recursive applications of interpret are sort of syntax-free. So they don't involve any syntax. The only syntax that pops up in this scheme is that we perform this case discrimination and that we bind those variables for the subterm, immediate subterm positions, and then recursively possess them. Okay, so this is compositionality. And now you might say, well, who cares? It looks nice, but why do we need compositionality? And I should point out that, you know, compositionality hasn't been invented for the purpose of writing fancy interpreters. Well, it's actually a principle that probably comes from logics. It has generally to do with, you know, what I said, with how the meaning of compound constructs, compound sentences, statements, should be determined through the meanings of the immediate sub-phrases. Okay, but for us as language engineers, compositionality is very useful because it helps us basically with formal reasoning. You know, you remember that we were already doing a bit of reasoning in this book here. There's this chapter 13, reasoning about programs, and you did things like equational reasoning and induction proofs, and it turns out that when you have compositionality that interpreters that are written in that style really make it easy for you to apply the proof scheme of structural induction, and that can be used in order to prove properties of language constructs or to prove correctness of transformations such as optimizations. Well, I mean, I don't want to go too much into this mathematical potential of compositionality, but, you know, at least I want to convince you that this is really the case, that you know, compositionality really makes it easy to reason about programs. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do formal proofs all the time, but, you know, it also helps you with informal reasoning, right? So I'm going to do an informal proof here of a simple property, and I'm going to use structural induction to this end. So we are going to prove the lemma that D the interpretation of the sublanguage, where we only allow for zero and suck, but not pret, such interpretation never fails. I mean, obviously this property should hold, right? Remember, we started from a very simple language with only zero and suck, and for that language the interpreter function was even total. So yes, of course that one never failed, and then we lifted up to a language with pret, and because of pret we had to add the maybe type constructor, so because of pret things got partial. So yes, so this property should hold, but how do we get, you know, confident in that this property holds? And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to use structural induction, and here we leverage the compositionality of the interpreter function. So we're going to use structural induction on the abstract syntax terms, right? And so basically our induction hypothesis shall be that the interpretation of subterms never fails, right? So the base case that we need to consider is the one for zero. So quite obviously the interpretation of the zero construct doesn't fail because it says just zero. Okay, and then we only have to consider one case here in the inductive step, because we don't have to consider pret, because we don't allow ourselves pret for this lemma. We only need to consider the case for suck. And then you see suck x, and then we see how it's interpreted. And so we look at it, like we realize that basically the right hand side of this equation is of the form f partially applied to a. So now actually induction hypothesis kicks in for a, because we are applying interpret to a smaller term, right? X is smaller than the term that we're looking at here. So the induction hypothesis is applicable, so we know that this interpretation does not fail. So if this interpretation does not fail, that function, by equational reasoning, gets applied. And so, obviously, because that function gets applied, it eventually returns just something. We know that also that part doesn't fail. Well, you might also ask, okay, how can we actually destroy the discipline of compositionality? So how would an interpreter look like that is not compositional? Okay, that's pretty simple. One way of messing up is to use side effects. Well, because in that case, the meaning of a compound term is no longer solely defined in terms of the meanings of the immediate subterms, because suddenly these side effects might kick in, right? Another way of stepping out of compositionality is that you might use deep patterns. Like you might want to say, hey, I would like to optimize my interpreter. I would like to add this equation where, you know, when I apply pret to suck on top of x, I could as well just shortcut and interpret only x. So what you could do is, yes, you could add an equation, but only if you prove its correctness relative to the compositional base semantics, okay? Well, and then another way of stepping out of compositionality would be to define the meaning of terms in terms of syntax again, right? So, you know, this is not our interpreter. I've picked a different example here. So this is about a language that has while and if, you know, like an imperative language. And if you would like to interpret while, one way of defining the semantics of while could be to say, well, you know, if I need to interpret the while, I could actually turn it into a sort of an if term, and if the condition holds, well, then I execute the body once, and then I try the while loop again. So, you know, this looks like a reasonable definition, but it's not compositional, because you do not define the meaning of the while loop just in terms of the meanings of the ingredients of the while. Rather, you build up some term here. But again, you can prove the correctness, the kind of the operational correctness of this sort of semantics relative to some other compositional baseline semantics that I'm not stating here. Anyway, so here's a little riddle for you. If you want to play a little bit more with compositionality, what you could do is could take our current interpreter and refactor it so that you have three different modules. You would have a syntax module, a meanings module, and an interpreter module. And so the idea would just be to take all the parts that we have seen so far and put them into these modules and to really take a close look at the module headers and at the import statements, so that you make sure that at least the meanings module does not import the syntax module. I think this is a simple exercise just to really understand compositionality. Okay, so we are ready for the next evolution step. So this time we want to deal with type tests in the sense that the interpreter has to perform all kinds of runtime type tests because of a more complicated value domain. So the extension that we use to this end is that we have a kind of a conditional construct, like an ifs and else at the expression level. And indeed, in order to at least have one form of condition, we also have an is zero test for numbers. Okay, so we can, for example, test whether this number n0 is zero, which indeed it is, and then we obviously have to commit to the then branch rather than to the else branch, therefore the result is just one. So the issue here is that we now have, as the result of is zero, for example, we have booleans, and as before, we also have natural numbers, so we have different value types, and this affects the interpreter, as we will see. So the syntactic part of the extension is very straightforward. We just have to add the constructor declarations for the new constructs, as before. One question that sometimes comes up in this context here is, well, are we really wise to have just one syntactic category for all expressions? Or should we perhaps better have like two syntactic categories, one for booleans, another one for natural numbers? And then, you know, the expectation is that by doing so, we might even avoid some type testing at runtime. Well, the problem is ultimately this approach doesn't scale, because, you know, once you add variables to your language, as we will do in a second, for variables, they can be of any type, and then, you know, it just doesn't work. So you have to keep your syntactic constructs together in one syntactic domain. And this is why type tests pop up. Anyway, so this is how our semantic domain value evolves in the view of this extension. Well, we simply need a union type, if you like, to inject both natural numbers and booleans into the union of possible values, right? And then semantic functions at first looks pretty innocent, because I actually wrote it in a style that emphasizes the compositionality. That is, I kind of separated out all the actual interesting parts into, you know, these auxiliary functions. So you don't see any type testing in this definition. However, you will see type tests in those guys here, suck and con and so on. But, you know, here you see another example of a clearly compositional definition. So let's look into these auxiliary functions here. You know, here are some examples. You know, these are the auxiliary functions that we need for the pre-existing constructs, zero, suck, and pred, and there are also auxiliary functions for the new constructs, for the is-zero test and the conditional. So what's new about this version here is that we have injections and projections, as I call them, everywhere in this code. I mean, these are the type tests, especially these projections are the type tests. I have to tell you how out nut and out bool is defined, but essentially it takes a value and it tries to give you a natural number or boolean, but it might fail, of course. I mean, there are straightforward definitions, right? So, but that's the point, that the interpreter throughout the code needs to perform type tests. So, for example, to establish that the argument of the suck construct indeed evaluates to the natural number and not to a boolean. Okay, and here's just a straightforward definition of these two projections. You see it basically just performs case discrimination on the value union, and it insists on, you know, naturals or booleans, whatever, and it fails when it doesn't find the kind of value that it likes. Okay, yeah, so this is how we see that an interpreter might be challenged by the value domain when there are different types of results. So slowly things are getting a little bit more interesting. So we will now deal with bindings, and in particular we will actually add the lambda calculus to our language that we interpret. Okay? So here's a little demo. So we are going to get constructs for lambda abstractions, you know, for variable access and for function application. So what we are doing here is with this demo, we actually define an increment function as a term in our extended language. You see lambda x and then apply successor on the argument x, and then we apply the increment function, this term, to the zero term, right? So we expect to get 1. So what is this here? Well, this is the additional argument position of the interpretation function for the bindings, right? So initially, as we start this little program, there are no a priori bindings, but eventually, as we hit this lambda abstraction throughout interpretation, there will be bindings such that, for example, x for a short moment in time will be bound to 0, okay? Well, so this is the syntactic part of the extension. That's still very straightforward. So we just have to add these three constructs, right? Variables, lambda abstractions, and function application. This is the lambda calculus. So we represent variables here as strings. And then a lambda abstraction, of course, is just the string for the variable to be bound plus the body of the lambda abstraction, which is an expression. Function application is simply two expressions. You know, the first expression hopefully is going to be a function, and the second expression is hopefully, you know, to be a kind of a value that can be used by the function. Okay? Well, so now we look at the semantic domains, how they change. I mean, now since we have functions in our interpreted language, in fact, for example, if we interpret a lambda abstraction, what's supposed to be the result of interpreting a lambda abstraction? Well, it's got to be a function by itself, right? So we have to add a kind of value to our union that already contains natural numbers and booleans. We have to add a case for functions. So our functions are like, you know, given a value, say, you know, for the argument of the function, we might get a value for the result of the function. Okay, and then as I said, the interpreter is going to use an environment for the bindings of some variables to some values, right? So the interpreter is going to pass around an environment like this. So we map strings for variables to values, to their bindings, okay? So now we have to look at the semantic functions and also at the auxiliary functions. And this is where, you know, this extension gets a little bit more involved. But, like, the overall story is that we need to take our pre-existing equations and we somehow need to lift them to this new level where we actually also pass around and maintain bindings, okay? And then, of course, we need to come up for appropriate equations for the three new constructs. Okay, so here's the part where we rewrite pre-existing equations, and I've kind of highlighted the changes that occur. Right? I mean, of course, the function signature for the interpret function now has this additional argument position that we also saw in the demo, where we are expected to pass around an environment, a mapping from strings to values. Right? And then, in all these equations, and in all these applications of interpret, we have to pass around this environment. I mean, these constructs are not concerned with the environment, but since we might eventually hit on a lambda abstraction or on a variable somewhere in a position, in a nested term position, we have to make sure that the environment gets everywhere, okay? So this is the part of, you know, lifting up the pre-existing interpreter to the new semantic model that involves environment. So now we need to go through these three new constructs and understand how they are modeled, how they are interpreted. Okay, so the first thing we face here is the construct for variables. So how do we interpret a variable? You know, we have this name of the variable and we have the environment. And, you know, just for the sake of a very compositional style, we delegate, you know, the actual decision, what the meaning is, to this auxiliary function var. Well, so what is the meaning of a variable? Well, it's very simple. It's essentially just defined through function application. We have to apply the environment, which is a binding of variables, to their values. We have to apply the environment to the variable name. That's it. That's very nice, right? So environment lookup is basically function application. Okay, so here is the lambda construct. That's a little bit more difficult. Well, we again kind of set everything up for compositional style, you know, pattern match on the lambda construct. We recursively process the subterm. However, as you see here, we don't pass E right away to that subterm because the body of the lambda abstraction is going to be evaluated, is going to be interpreted relative to some slightly adjusted environment. So we don't pass E here. Okay, so we delegate all the fine details, except for the recursive interpretation, to that auxiliary function lambda. Lambda takes the current environment, it takes the name of the variable of the lambda abstraction, and it takes the already kind of recursively interpreted body of the lambda abstraction. So this is the typing situation here. And then now it's clear, as I said, somehow the semantic meaning of a lambda abstraction has to be essentially a function. So therefore you see that we indeed inject into the value domain here by using the infun injection, right? But what sort of function is it here? Well, so we take the argument of the function, so this is actually a lambda abstraction in Haskell that helps us modeling the semantics of the lambda abstraction of our interpreted language, and then we say, well, essentially the result of the function application relative to this argument is obtained by f. F is the meaning of the body of the lambda abstraction, and we need to give it still an environment. And what's the environment? Well, it's essentially the environment E that we saw, you know, when we hit the lambda abstraction, except that we modify this environment at the point N for the variable of the lambda abstraction to assume the argument that we're waiting for. Okay, so this is a little bit complicated, but it's also cool that we can actually do it at all on one slide here, like this. And here's the auxiliary function that we use up here. This is like point-wise function modification. You know, given a function, and given an argument, and given a result, we kind of produce a function that behaves like the original function, except for the location x here, you know, in which case we return that y, and in order to decide whether we are facing the point of interest, of course we need the argument domain to instantiate the eq class. Okay? Yeah, so this is the semantics of the lambda abstraction, and that's sort of the interesting part of the extension here. So really the important thing is that we essentially map a lambda abstraction to a function in Haskell, and we basically defer constructing the final environment for that function by waiting until we have the argument, which we then bind in this preliminary environment, and then we essentially defer interpretation to the body of the lambda abstraction. So that's pretty cool. So here's the interpretation of function application. Okay, so again, very compositional. So we interpret the function position, we interpret the argument position, and then we defer all fine details to an auxiliary function apply. So what we have here is, we have like, we take like two maybe values, namely the function position and the argument position, and we possibly return a value as the result of function application. So, you know, this is a little bit cryptic at first hand, but, you know, this is very pure style of programming. Actually, next time we're going to make this a little bit more readable, but in a way, this is the very true, very pure functional story, how functional application has to work also in the view of the necessary type test, namely that the first argument must be a function rather than a boolean, also in the view of the fact that all these things are partial. So what you see here is, you know, we first take the f, and by partial function application, we make sure that at least the position for the function, for function application, you know, is a proper value rather than nothing. Then we also take the argument for the function application, and again through partial function application, we make sure that this is also some sort of value, right? And then, additionally, we have to make sure that actually the position for the function is not just any value, but it is a function kind of value. So therefore we have a third partial function application here. And then when we have done all these tests, we are ready to apply, you know, the function, that's really a function, to the argument. So anyway, so this is also the semantics of apply. So we are done with adding the lambda calculus to our language that we are interpreting here. So here's a little riddle for you. That's a little bit more complicated because you really would need to think a little bit about eagerness and laziness and probably come up with some examples. But, you know, the exercise would be, can you actually change the interpreter that we just have seen so that it deals somewhat nicer with, you know, possibly failing or possibly diverging arguments in function application. You know, currently, how it's set up, if an argument of a function application would fail or diverge, we would actually propagate this failure, or we would also propagate that divergence. I mean, you actually see this from how we, you know, insist on processing the argument here. So the riddles really can be do somewhat better, you know, that we don't necessarily diverge just because the argument diverges, or that we don't necessarily fail just because the argument fails. Okay. So there's one more extension that I want to deliver to you, and that one is about recursion. So we want to be able to sort of define functions recursively within the interpreted language. Here's a sketch. There are not all the details, but this is what we want to be able to do. For example, we want to be able to define a factorial function. And, you know, in this session here, we eventually apply the factorial function to the natural number 5, right? So we have to figure out how to define a recursive function, you know, in our interpreted language. But before I do this, I want to step back a little bit and show you one related way of modeling recursion within just plain Haskell. I mean, of course, it's easy to define recursive functions in Haskell because you're allowed to refer to a function that you are defining in the body of the function. However, as this session here shows, there's also a nice way of kind of getting recursion without, you know, referencing the function itself. So what we do here is we kind of approach the definition of the factorial in two phases. So we start with this version here. So this kind of factorial function, you know, takes an additional parameter f, and that parameter is meant to model, you know, the recursive use of the factorial function. However, it's just a plain parameter position, right? Nothing special. So you see, this looks like the factorial function in Haskell, except that in the position where we would normally invoke factorial recursively, we use that extra parameter f. So now we still can get the recursive form here by using a special combinator. This is the so-called least fixed point combinator of Haskell, and actually its definition is right here. So how is it defined? So the name of the function is fix. Fix takes the function and computes the fixed point of the function. Well, how does it do that? Well, everything is here in this little line. So it basically uses the definitional property of a fixed point to compute the fixed point. At least that works in Haskell. So you see, to take a fixed point of a function f, what we do is we apply the function f to the fixed point of the function f. You know, if you now kind of apply this scheme to this function here, you see that we basically, you know, when we take the fixed point of factorial, we, you know, apply the factorial and we pass in the fixed point of the factorial here with this argument f, right? And therefore we can now compute the normal factorial through the fixed point of our non-recursive fact function. Okay, so this is cool. And I mean, this is an important trick that we will use when we kind of extend our interpreted language to deal with recursion. So the first approach to recursion in our interpreted language that I want to show you is that we sort of assume that we also have a fixed point combinator within the interpreted language. So you see here we define a factorial function, you know, this is a little bit verbose, but this is basically the same kind of scheme, right? We test whether the argument is 0, and if it is, we return 1 as the result of the factorial function. Otherwise, we perform some multiplication, so we assume that we have multiplication defined, so we multiply x with the recursive application. So again, we have the special argument f here, you know, as a proxy for the recursive reference to factorial, as in the Haskell code that we just saw. Yes, yeah, so we apply this f to the predecessor of the argument x. So yeah, so we basically sort of assume here that we have a fixed point combinator in the interpreted language. Well, actually, this guy could be, you know, a new construct, so we could have a fixed point combinator, you know, as an additional construct in our language. Or was actually also possible, as I will show you, and it's surprising for those who don't know about this trick yet, we can actually define a lambda term just on in terms of the expressiveness that we already have for that combinator. So here is the lambda term for the so-called Kolbe-Wylie fixed point combinator. So you know, this is not very easy to see that this is a fixed point combinator. So you know, you need to look at this for a while to get an intuition. I mean, what you see here is that essentially, this is a kind of a self-copying operator. So whenever it's applied, you know, it sort of copies itself, and this is how you get this kind of fixed point behavior. Anyway, so the take-home lesson here is there's some standard way of expressing a fixed point combinator within the lambda calculus, which means that once we have lambda calculus, we can already do recursion because we just have to use, you know, that lambda expression in order to take the fixed point of some function. Well, I mean, one issue with this fixed point combinator is that its type is a little bit unclear. So, you know, if you would want to impose a type system on our interpreted language, probably this approach wouldn't scale. Okay, anyway, so here's the second approach how we can get recursion into our interpreted language. And it's more than just, you know, getting rid of this fancy lambda expression for the fixed point combinator. Rather, it also generalizes the whole thing a little bit insofar that we are able to use, you know, recursive bindings properly. So we now can use, we are now allowed to use the name of a function within the body as a way of recursive reference, which is more convenient than writing down, you know, recursive functions with this additional argument f, which is a proxy for the recursive reference. So we want to add like proper syntactic sugar for recursion to our language. So we are going to get lad rec construct, and here you see how we intend to use it. You know, we actually have like a chain of lad recs where we first, you know, define addition recursively on top of piano, and then we have multiplication on top of addition, and then we have factorial on top of all those, and eventually we can apply the factorial function. So now it's going to be interesting to see how that track is added to our interpreted language. Well, of course, we just have to add one constructor declaration here. You know, let rec. First argument is the name of the recursive binding. Second one is the body of the recursive binding. And the third argument is for the expression in which we want to use the recursive binding, right? So now, this is the semantics of the let rec construct. And this is quite interesting, right? So what we do here is we essentially interpret the let rec construct by interpreting, as you see, you know, the second expression. Because, you know, the second expression is the expression in which we want to use the binding. So, yes, so we interpret the second expression. But what is the environment in which we interpret this expression? Well, it's of course not just that environment, because we have to realize the recursive binding. So essentially we have to somehow modify the incoming environment to include this recursive binding here. So you see that we interpret the first expression, which is the body of the recursive binding, and you see that we update the environment in the position n for the recursive binding. And now you see a cool thing. What we are doing here is, because it's about a recursive binding, we are actually interpreting the body of the recursive binding relative to the environment that we are sort of computing here, right? And this is also the environment that we're passing into X2. So, you know, because it's a recursive binding, we have to also compute the binding, the environment, recursively, and as a solution of a fixed point equation. So we use this guy that we have seen before. Yes, and this is the quite surprising semantics of the let rec construct, which allows us to have, you know, truly recursive definitions in our interpreted language, where we can really use names for recursive references. And here's a little riddle. I think this is not too hard. I mean, if you already have played with type systems in the past. So I'm basically suggesting that you might want to implement a little type system for this language with let rec. So this type system would need to distinguish basic types such as nut, bool, and then because the conditional is sort of polymorphic in the then and the else branch, and also variables might be sort of polymorphic, actually you also need like type variables. So there's nut, bool, and type variables, and then you can construct types on top of these basic types through the arrow type constructor, right? So we have function types. So I would suggest that you implement a type checker or type inference engine for our applicative lambda calculus with LatRec. That would be a cool exercise to try. Okay, so we could go on like this forever and add many more extensions to our language, but obviously we run out of time. I mean, it's just an indication, right? We might want to have recursive binding groups rather than just single bindings. We might want to deal with records and perhaps even objects at some point. Of course, we might want to have state, like, you know, variables with assignment. You might want to have other side effects. You might want to have exception handling, and so on and so forth. And actually, it would be interesting to go through all these extensions, because again, it would make our interpreter more interesting, and it would be more structure, more functional programming, you know, insights revealed. But, you know, we run out of time today. So here are some further reading pointers. So this is like, you know, the one by John C. Reynolds, Definitional Interpreters for Higher Order Programming Languages. This is a seminal article that also had been reprinted a few years back. It's really about what we're doing here, but of course much more seriously. You know, it investigates how we can use interpreters to understand one language through another language. And it's also very strong insofar that it really is strongly inspired by denotational semantics, and it tries to write these interpreters in a disciplined fashion so that they can really serve a definitional purpose. That is, that it can really define the language in some, you know, nearly mathematical fashion. And, you know, there are some textbooks I want to mention, you know, for some, the one by Tennant here. That one also covers denotational semantics in particular, so it's good for the kind of interpretation we have done here today. Or another textbook, you know, by Sloniger and Kurtz, also about programming languages in general, but it also covers denotational semantics. Actually uses Prolog for some part. And so these are good, you know, if you want to read up a little bit on programming language theory with coverage of interpreters and with a denotational style approach in particular. So here there's also a book I want to mention, and that's actually also online available, just like the one by Sloniger, by the way. So Shriram Krishnamurti's book actually uses, I believe, Scheme for all kinds of interpreter experiments, but it's more like an operational semantic style used there. And indeed there are many other textbooks that, you know, that use more operational semantics, like this one, for example, by Carly Gunter, and let's see. Yeah, so here's an even more, more pragmatic approach to the discussion of interpreters by Samuel Kamin. And I could go on like this. So there are tons of books on programming language theory, obviously, and they all, you know, deal with some sort of interpretation. Anyway, but these are my favorite recommendations. Okay, and then here's what we want to do next time. Basically, we want to, you know, layer on top of what we have developed today. So we will, you know, play with interpreters. So I want to explain you monads and monad transformers. You're probably already waiting for this. I want to kind of play again with maps and folds, but not for lists, but rather for abstract syntaxes this time. And I might probably get a little bit more into functional or programming, like how can you do these things reasonably in a language like C#. Okay, and that's it for today, and thanks a lot, and see you soon.